Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Okay, January 28 was not the day the music died, but something wonderful was alive back when Paul Kantner and Signe Anderson were flourishing, and that something is long dead. Or is it? I'll explore with some help from commentator Glenn Ford, W.H. Auden, and the Jefferson Airplane. I hope you'll stay tuned. I am usually unmoved when a famous actor or musician dies. I'm not necessarily proud of this. It might be a certain moral numbness on my part, but that's the way I am. For me, February 3, 1959 was not the day the music died. I was alive on that day and acquainted with some of Buddy Holly's music. But I didn't even discover he was dead until many years later, to say nothing of the Big Bopper, whoever he was. Okay, I was only 8 1/2 at the time they died. And no, I haven't forgotten Ritchie Valens. But even later, the deaths of Jimi Hendrix, of Janis Joplin, even of John Lennon, failed to make much of an impression on me. Then, a couple of weeks ago, I came across an obituary of a fairly obscure musician, one Signe Tolley Anderson. I learned from it that, in fact, she and Paul Kantner both had died on the same day, January 28, 2016. Both had been members of the famed San Francisco psychedelic rock band Jefferson Airplane. Signe Anderson was the group's first female vocalist. She left the group after their first album and was replaced by Grace Slick. Paul Kantner was a singer and the group's rhythm guitarist. Somehow the deaths on the same day of both Signe Anderson and Paul Kantner struck a nerve, moved me, saddened me, reminded me of something important we have lost. For me, Jefferson Airplane created the quintessential music of the late 1960s. The period I came of age, and changed in other ways too. My college years. The years I realized that my own government was prosecuting an immoral and evil war abroad, accompanied by stunning repression at home. With the military draft in full force, I had to decide what I would and would not do, and what consequences I was prepared to endure. I and several million other young people. Pretty heady stuff for a 19-year-old from a small town in Pennsylvania. And yet we, who ended up opposing the system, never felt hopeless or alone. There were large numbers of people opting out of the mainstream capitalistic war machine and creating alternatives before our very eyes, all around. Many, many alternative communities united by our refusal to accept the evil machine. At least most of us united in celebrating the virtues of peace, love, sexual liberation, and nonviolence. We saw ourselves not as social dropouts, but as the counterculture. Most of us didn't enlist in the counterculture completely. I myself stayed pretty conventional in many respects. But we identified with and participated in the movement, the counterculture. Make love, not war, the slogan went, and we did. We burned our draft cards and the occasional draft board's office files. What I miss especially from those days is the sense of optimism and of community, of the power of the grassroots, the power of the people. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young sang, "We Can Change the World, Rearrange the World," and we felt it was true. That's what I miss especially, the feeling that our name is Legion, we peace and love types, for we are many, the feeling that we really could change the world. And we were partially right. We could and did. To an extent. For a while. Then it pretty much changed back. Eventually, the establishment and the war machine and the capitalism machine and the plutocracy regained the upper hand. And that was the end of the counterculture and Hate Ashbury and the Summer of Love and the chant, "Hell no, we won't go." Maybe all old men feel this nostalgia for their youthful days. I don't know. But I really do miss the feeling that the people did have some power to shape events. The feeling of endless possibilities. And I deeply miss the feeling that I am part of an alternative community. That I am not alone. There are millions like me. We recognize one another as brothers and sisters. Water brothers. We help one another. The Jefferson Airplane captured the sense of optimism and love and power and possibilities of the alternative community. The deaths of Signe Anderson and Paul Kantner hit me hard because the Jefferson Airplane symbolized and fostered the feelings of hope and power to the people and community. The feelings that an alternative world was not only possible, it was being built all around us. A better world of love and peace and justice. A new continent of earth and fire. We could see it happening locally. And the people in this alternative world looked beautiful and seemed authentic. And the sex was great. And the popular music struck a chord deep in the soul. And for me, the music of Jefferson Airplane struck the chord the most deeply. They did then, and they still do today. Here are some passages from the Airplane that beautifully celebrate the beauty of the counterculture and the power of the counterculture to change the world for the better. The late Signe Anderson is not involved in this selection. The late Paul Kantner is. I thank them both. But I think what should make us grieve is not the loss of two good musicians, but the loss of community and optimism and alternatives and hope. The stuff that the Jefferson Airplane's music embodies and celebrates. As some lyrics go, "We can be together, my friend. A new continent of earth and fire. Tear down the walls. Tear down the walls. Won't you try?"
Must begin here.
Jefferson Airplane. We commemorate the deaths of members Paul Kantner and Signe Tolle Anderson, each at the age of 74, each of cancer, each died on January 28, 2016. We heard parts of the Airplane's songs We Can Be Together and Volunteers. My thoughts about this seminal counterculture rock band triggered a few other thoughts. Several weeks ago, I saw Stanley Nelson's new documentary film, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. The Black Panthers and the Jefferson Airplane were from about the same period. The Panthers were an anti-establishment, grassroots, black power group, and remarkably effective in gaining members and followers. Enough to scare the bejesus out of J. Edgar Hoover and his clones in urban police departments coast to coast, notably Chicago. With the help of the FBI, Chicago's cops attacked and killed the charismatic and effective Panther leader, Fred Hampton, as he slept in his own bed. This assassination came as no great surprise to the Panthers, or to the white members of the counterculture. Many of them had recently had their heads bashed by the Chicago cops while peacefully protesting outside the site of the 1968 Democratic Convention. The lines I quoted a few minutes ago from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young were referring to this incident in Chicago. And we shall hear more about the Chicago police today, in a moment, from Glenn Ford. Some things never seem to change. Watching the Black Panthers movie, I was struck again by how beautiful the counterculture types looked. The Panthers, male and female, with their youth and their bearing that proclaimed strength and self-confidence and personal power. And those beautiful afros, as the natural hairstyle was called. A popular slogan of the time was, "Black is beautiful." And it was. The Jefferson Airplane and the counterculture it represented also made me think of Occupy Wall Street. October 2011 is when this movement began. It was small, perhaps, but quite reminiscent of the late 1960s. It came 43 years after 1968. But 2011 was the first time that large numbers of American people were acting like we did back when Jefferson Airplane was singing We Can Be Together. My heart leapt up when I beheld this rainbow in the sky. And you know it takes a lot to get me quoting Wordsworth. In recent days, we've also seen grassroots rebellion, a lot of it in a lot of places, by black people. Outraged at the callous indifference and the violence the establishment is inflicting upon them. Police killings of black people especially, and not that only. A new wrinkle is that today many more black people are holding government office than they did back in the late 1960s, including the highest elected government office. However, that representation has made precious little difference to the average black citizen, or to anyone else. Commentator Glenn Ford has talked for years of how very many black office holders have sold out their constituents and aligned themselves with the establishment. Ford refers to them as the black misleadership class. But sometimes the power of the people and the outrage of the people gets strong enough that even their elected misleaders are forced to do the right thing, to an extent. Here is Glenn Ford with a brief commentary. It is titled, Youth Leads the Struggle in Chicago.
Chicago Sun-Times columnist Lynn Sweet said she hadn't seen Mayor Rahm Emanuel so shaken in 20 years as when he was forced to fire his police superintendent, Gary McCarthy, this week. It seemed as if the protective shield of black misleadership class collaboration that has for the last 30 years insulated white mayors from the wrath of Chicago's outraged black rank and file had suddenly been stripped away. Black ministers joined militant youth in marching down the city's Magic Mile Michigan Avenue shopping district, demanding that heads roll for hiding video evidence in the death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, shot 16 times by Officer Jason Van Dyke. For 400 days, Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez refused to indict the cop or release the police dashboard video of the shooting or to explain why another critical video had apparently been destroyed. Alvarez finally bowed to pressure and a court order indicting the cop for first-degree murder and releasing the death video. But the community's rage could not be contained. The Black Caucus of Chicago's Board of Aldermen demanded that Police Superintendent McCarthy resign. So did Reverend Jesse Jackson and even Bobby Rush, the sellout black congressman who's been a dependable servant of the Emanuel administration. The strength of the movement in Chicago can be measured by the fact that so many elements of the black collaborationist political class have been forced to take a stance in opposition to Mayor Emanuel and the white corporate forces that he represents, and ultimately to compel the mayor to fire his favorite cop. However, if left to their own devices, if allowed to seize control of what is essentially a black youth political rebellion, the black misleaders will smother the movement in proceduralisms and long drawn-out studies and compliant advisory boards and all manner of other diversions, as they have always done. That's their job as the black junior partners in the permanent white corporate state. The young people that are the soldiers of this struggle understand that movements are defined by their demands. In a joint statement by the Black Youth Project 100, We Charge Genocide, Asada's Daughters, the Let Us Breathe Collective, and a Black Lives Matter chapter, they declared that indicting cops does not change the policies that promote the violence and trauma inherent in the Chicago Police Department. They want Rahm Emanuel's resignation, too. The Black Youth Project also demands defunding of the Chicago Police and investment of those dollars in the black community. They call for reparations for slavery, Jim Crow, and mass black incarceration, an end to all profit in the criminal justice system, a guaranteed income for all, a federal jobs program, and freedom from discrimination for all workers, and an end to displacement of black people through gentrification. These are demands for social transformation, demands that will put the young activists on a collision course with the black misleadership class, who are the first line of defense for the white ruling class, and who will soon close ranks in Chicago and elsewhere to try to stop this movement. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
In Chicago, bad cops serving a corrupt municipal government, which in turn serves the corrupt ruling elite. As it is today, so it was in my day, and so it was in Chicago long before that, too. Hey, I never said that 1968 was paradise, just that there was something wonderful in the air, and it wasn't just tetrahydrocannabinol either. The scent of freedom was in the air, and possibility, and alternatives, and a new world with more love and less violence and no more war. There was a big war going on at the time in Vietnam, but we had hopes of bringing it to an end, starting with ending our own individual complicity right now. And in fact, the people eventually did stop that war. Of course, in 1968, as now, many American people had no sympathy for the counterculture. Many people were trained to be passive and obedient, trained to obey all authority, to blindly follow custom, to not make waves, to keep their noses clean, to conform in all ways. All the corporate-controlled media urged them to stay the course, and so did all the established mainstream churches, to say nothing of the Boy Scouts. I, too, was brought up to be like that. I changed a lot when I went off to college. Others didn't. W. H. Auden has a nice poem satirizing the unthinking, obedient conformists that the government and the corporate elite want the citizens to become. I discovered the poem about the same time I discovered the Jefferson Airplane, 1968 or 69. It's called The Unknown Citizen. Auden wrote it in 1939, just before World War II. But it wasn't Hitler that Auden was trying to warn us about. In this poem, he imagines a monument that the establishment erects, celebrating the ideal, conformist, unthinking, obedient dolt that the establishment wants the average citizen to be. The opposite of the 1960s counterculture. The poem's words are the supposed inscription on this grand monument, honoring the ideal, patriotic, obedient non-entity. No draft card burner, he. It's good satire, down to the bad meter and rhymes. Just what you'd expect from a government bureaucrat. Let me read it. The Unknown Citizen. To JS/07/M/378, this marble monument is erected by the state. He was found by the Bureau of Statistics to be one against whom there was no official complaint, and all the reports on his conduct agree that, in the modern sense of an old-fashioned word, he was a saint, for in everything he did, he served the greater community. Except for the war, till the day he retired, he worked in a factory and never got fired, but satisfied his employers, Fudge Motors, Inc. Yet he wasn't a scab or odd in his views, for his union reports that he paid his dues. Our report on his union shows it was sound. And our social psychology workers found that he was popular with his mates and liked to drink. The press are convinced that he bought a paper every day, and that his reactions to advertisements were normal in every way. Policies taken out in his name prove that he was fully insured, and his health card shows that he was once in the hospital but left it cured. Both Producer's Research and High Grade Living declare he was fully sensible to the advantages of the installment plan, and had everything necessary to the modern man, a phonograph, a radio, a car, and a Frigidaire. Our researchers into public opinion are content that he held the proper opinions for the time of year. When there was peace, he was for peace. When there was war, he went. He was married and added 5 children to the population, which our eugenist says was the right number for a parent of his generation, and our teachers report that he never interfered with their education. Was he free? Was he happy? The question is absurd. Had anything been wrong, we should certainly have heard. With W. H. Auden's The Unknown Citizen, we end our eulogy for a better time, a period when the 99% was not so beaten down, depressed, and oppressed as we seem today. Or maybe things aren't quite so bad as all that. Maybe Occupy Wall Street was more than just a flash in the pan. As Glenn Ford notes, the black citizens are getting mighty fed up and taking to the streets, demanding change, and people of other colors are joining them too. Maybe the late 1960s is not ancient history after all. We can only hope. In any case, rest in peace, Paul Kantner and Signe Tolle Anderson. Thank you for listening to New World Notes, broadcasting from all along the Watchtower here in Darkest Connecticut. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, war is not healthy for children and other living things. Tune in, turn on, and please come back again next week. Power to the people. Right on.